Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an examination of how some of America's biggest corporations, as members of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, have joined forces with the NRA to strike down gun laws and implement permissive conceal and carry gun laws, as well as make it easier to buy machine guns. Lisa Graves, the Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and publisher of ALECExposed.org, joins us to discuss the extent to which corporate America has blood on its hands. Then, following the recent display of heroism by six teachers who died protecting young children, we'll look into the corporate war on teachers with Henry Giroux, a writer and current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. We will discuss the denigration and downsizing of teachers and the defunding of their unions by corporate and billionaire backers of ALEC and their political hirelings in Congress and state legislatures. Then finally, Catherine Newman joins us. She is the Dean of the School of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University and author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. We will discuss the latest classroom massacre in America and her article at CNN in School Shootings, Patterns and Warning Signs. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, who is Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of PR Watch, ALECExposed.org, Source Watch, and Bankster USA. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And you're connecting this ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, with the NRA, and in a sense suggesting that big money and the gun agenda have merged, and this has been going on for some time. So give us some details about what we're missing here.
Well, sure. I think a lot of Americans are frustrated by the lack of traction on gun laws to protect our communities, to protect our children. And one of the things that we have discovered through our research is how much of the gun agenda at the state level has been pushed over the last two decades by a group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. ALEC describes itself as the largest voluntary body of state legislators in the country, but in fact, it's largely funded by some of the biggest corporations in the world. Over 98% of its budget comes from corporations and sources other than legislators who pay $50 in dues a year. What happens through ALEC is that corporations pay for so-called scholarships for your elected state senators and state representatives to travel to posh resorts. And at those posh resorts where those legislators and their spouses are wined and dined with cigar parties and special dinners and baseball outings and other special events for them, at those meetings during the day, ALEC has task forces. Those task forces meet behind closed doors. The press and the public are not allowed to be present in those meetings. And at those meetings, what literally happens is that corporate lobbyists and special interest group lobbyists like the NRA vote behind closed doors on model legislation to change our rights, and in particular in the area of guns and violence, to make it easier for people to get access to the most deadly weapons in this country and to make it harder for cities and communities to regulate those weapons. And so ALEC is behind a number of bills that are extremely controversial, including the bill that gained notoriety earlier this year, the so-called Stand Your Ground bill, that was actually a law passed in Florida by ALEC legislators at the behest of the NRA. And then after that law was signed into effect by Jeb Bush, it was taken to ALEC to one of these secret closed-door meetings that was co-chaired by Walmart, the biggest seller of ammunition, the biggest retailer of ammunition and long guns in the world. And it was approved unanimously as an ideal bill to be pushed in cities and pushed in states across the country. And in fact, it was. Nearly three dozen states have adopted that law or parts of it in the past 7 years. And so ALEC and the NRA have been buddies, have been partners in pushing the gun agenda of the gun manufacturers that actually bankroll the NRA through these laws to make it more difficult for states and for citizens, in essence, to regulate these types of weapons. And in particular, last year, a year ago, at the secret closed-door ALEC meeting that we helped expose, the NRA pushed through an amendment to one of these ALEC bills that would bar cities, from banning machine guns, from banning automatic firing weapons, in which you pull the trigger once, an unlimited number of bullets come out of that gun.
So there has been an exodus, if you will, of some of the large U.S. corporations from ALEC following the Stand Your Ground controversy down in Florida with the shooting of Trayvon Martin. However, still ALEC includes ExxonMobil Corporation, GlaxoSmithKline, Koch Industries, no surprise there, Pfizer, Pharma, Reynolds America, United Parcels, AT&T, and State Farm Insurance. Now, apparently, you've written here, Lisa, at ALEC's annual meeting this summer, the NRA had the biggest booth at the convention in Salt Lake City and underwrote a shooting event along with one of the largest sellers of assault weapons in the world. Which one is that? Is that the one that was used in the latest tragedy with the elementary school?
No. In fact, the shooting event that ALEC that was held at the ALEC convention on the Saturday following the ALEC convention for ALEC legislators and corporate lobbyists was co-sponsored by the NRA and by Browning. Now, Browning is a longtime hunting rifle company in the U.S. It's been purchased by a Swiss company that is one of the biggest sellers of machine guns, of assault weapons in the world. But unfortunately, there are a number of these merchants of these machine guns, and that's just one of them. Almost all of these major corporations fund the NRA, and the NRA in turn funds ALEC. And so certainly some of ALEC's agenda is paid for in part, or was paid for many, many years in part by these gun manufacturers who don't want to have these types of restrictions and, in fact, want to make it easier to have access to these types of weapons that are, you know, that help their bottom line, to help increase their profits.
Well, apparently, along with ALEC laws that have been passed around the country, of course, most prominently, the ALEC NRA agenda was pushed through by Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin, and he got an award from the NRA from his implementation of these laws, like the Stand Your Ground law that we noticed down in Florida with the killing of Trayvon Martin. But ironically, which was the city in Connecticut that recently repealed the only ban in the state on carrying concealed firearms? And that was at the behest of the NRA's lobbying efforts.
Right. There's another city just a couple miles away from Newton, Connecticut. It's about maybe an hour away that recently repealed a bar on concealed carrying of firearms. And so it wasn't Newton, but it was in the neighborhood, in essence. And we've learned this weekend from the New York Times that, in fact, there was an effort in Newton, which is the larger town around Sandy Hook, that in that town there was a recent effort to limit people from firing weapons in the woods, an effort to give the police greater power to regulate it when people are shooting weapons within 500 feet of a house or maybe even closer. And that effort was thwarted by NRA members and gun advocates from taking effect. And so you do have a culture there in Connecticut, unfortunately, that appears to have made the use of guns, the idea that the shooter's mother brought her child to gun firing ranges to be able to shoot more accurately, sort of a normalization of the gun culture in Connecticut. And it was sort of surprising to see that just a little while ago in Connecticut, in one of the towns, the bar on concealed carry was dropped. In fact, the other thing that happened last week was that in Michigan, along with the effort to cram through the ALEC wish list on union busting in the so-called right-to-work law, one of the other things that was passed in the Michigan legislature was another part of the ALEC agenda, which was to expand the ease of concealed carrying of firearms in the state of Michigan. So ALEC, while ALEC says it's no longer pushing this agenda, the NRA clearly is. and ALEC is doing nothing to repeal or to push to repeal many of these types of laws that basically advance the agenda of both the NRA and the gun manufacturers that bankroll it.
Well, in that conceal carry law that was just passed, along with the union busting right to work law in Michigan, didn't that law also include that teachers are allowed to carry guns or encourage teachers to carry guns? I read that somewhere.
Well, it's interesting. I think there's been two sort of strains that have been merging. One is that where in many of the states that have adopted these concealed carrying laws or have adopted reciprocity agreements to basically allow you to carry your concealed weapon from one state to another if your home state allows you to have a permit to have a concealed firearm, that what those way those laws work is that they're basically taking your traditional right, in essence, to have a gun in your home to defend yourself and giving you a right to carry that gun on the streets in public places, in public spaces. And in those public spaces, what they're saying is you can carry that gun, but you can't carry it openly so people know that you have it or that might cause people some fear. You carry it in a concealed fashion, which many people have been concerned about, having a situation in which that may lead to increased violence because people may not realize that the person they're having an argument with is actually, you know, packing a pistol. And in fact, what you see in the case of Trayvon Martin is the confluence of both sort of the idea, or that you can see the danger of this idea. You could have a state that has a law that says you can carry a concealed weapon, along with a state that has passed another ALEC law that says you have this stand your ground right to shoot to kill if you think you're being threatened. And someone may not even realize you've got a gun on you. And so I think it's a recipe for disaster. In terms of the schools, though, one of the shocking things that we've seen beyond just the horrifying, shocking nature of the crimes in Connecticut that stole the lives of those children and their teachers, one of the shocking things is that one of the first things out of the box by gun defenders was to say that that teachers should be carrying guns, that teachers should be armed, and even to blame the idea of schools as a gun-free zone, which many states have adopted and many cities have adopted, that somehow was the cause of this tragedy, that if the school were not a gun-free zone, meaning we're in a city or state where a person has the right to carry a concealed firearm, the place they cannot carry it is in a school because that's a gun-free zone, and there are special criminal penalties if a crime is committed in a gun-free zone involving a gun. Some of these gun advocates have been saying that we just needed more teachers armed with comparable weapons in those schools, and that's how we'll keep our children safe.
Again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who is Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of PR Watch, alecexposed.org, SourceWatch, and Bankster USA. She served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. When you were a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, Lisa, I understand you worked on gun issues, so you're the perfect person to comment on the New York Times story that indicated that after the shooting of Congresswoman Giffords down in Arizona, along with the deaths of a number of people standing by her as she campaigned as a congressperson, exercising in the exercise of American democracy, the Justice Department apparently decided to revise some of the gun laws and implement some real gun laws, and that all sort of fizzled. And in many ways, it got sidetracked by that bogus witch hunt on the part of Darrell Issa and the Republicans in Congress over this trumped-up so-called Operation Fast and Furious. So give us a sense of what was going on in the Justice Department when you were there, and what can they do, given that the president, meeting with the victims in the town of Newton, Connecticut, did talk about that we have to do something, we have to protect our children. So if he calls up Eric Holder, if Obama calls up Eric Holder and says we got to do something, what can the Justice Department do?
Well, I think the Justice Department can do a lot of things. You know, there are a whole set of proposals that I worked on when I was at the Justice Department called the National Integrated firearms violence reduction strategy. It's a pretty cumbersome word for a set of proposals that include closing the gun show loophole and ensuring that the assault weapons ban would continue. That ban was allowed to expire in the George W. Bush administration, and there's been no traction before now in getting that ban in place and improved upon. And so there are a number of things that could be done that the Justice Department could put together based on ideas that were basically shelved by the Bush administration and not put back into play. But, you know, I think that one of the really stunning things about ALEC and the NRA agenda is that, you know, after the terrible school shootings at Virginia Tech, which is the other one of the other recent extremely deadly shootings at a school, instead of embracing efforts to address some of these problems with the access to these rapid-firing weapons and these big clips of ammunition that allow a shooter to kill so many people so quickly, instead of addressing that directly, what ALEC and the NRA did was to say that there should be no bars of guns on campus. And so basically they play offense all the time. So in the face of a tragedy like Virginia Tech, what ALEC and the NRA did was say what really needs to happen is that, you know, college students should just be armed. More and more college students should just be armed. And that's a consistent position with the NRA, that with the escalation in the number of people who have guns, what we need is more people to have guns. And so it's sort of this ever repeating cycle or circle. The more guns we have, the more you need guns to defend yourself against the more guns, which requires more guns, more guns, more guns. And who does that benefit? Gun manufacturers, of course. It's not actually a sensible solution to the crises that we face, both from the standpoint of mental health and the number of young men and younger Americans who are unstable, and the confluence of having someone who is depressed and unstable having access to these types of extraordinarily deadly weapons that can kill many people in the matter of seconds.
Well, but there is a reason why the United States, among the advanced democracies, is alone in not having any government protection of its citizens based upon correlating data between the mentally ill and those who purchase firearms. And the reason for that is that the NRA has consistently crippled the federal agency, the ATF, from doing its job and from protecting American citizens. So there is a reason why we are alone in the apparent the ease with which mentally disturbed people can get hold of firearms, and that all is on the NRA. So why are these big American corporations in bed with this psychotic agenda that is destroying American lives?
Well, you know, it really is quite stunning, because what you saw was before this year, a number of these corporations, Coca-Cola, Walmart, Pepsi-Cola, Bank of America, General Motors, General Electric, the CVS and Walgreens stores, and others that were longstanding members of ALEC, and they knew that this gun agenda was going on. They got the ALEC publications. They were at the conventions. Their representatives were there. Some of them were even on the committees, like Walmart, the particular task force on guns. Coke Industries was actually not just been a longtime funder of ALEC through the family foundations of the Koch brothers, and also through the corporation held by the two of the richest men in the world, these right-wing ideologues who are attempting to distort our democracy in many ways. But Koch Industries was actually the chair of ALEC's corporate board at a time in which ALEC said that law enforcement should not be able to select a gun manufacturers for the purchase of weapons for police based on whether a manufacturer has adopted a voluntary code of conduct in terms of trying to prevent people from who shouldn't have guns from getting access to them, and other voluntary measures. And so this is indeed an extreme agenda, and it's one that's been peddled by ALEC. It's been peddled by the NRA, and it's been made possible by the donations of these major corporations to underwrite ALEC's overall agenda, and they should be held accountable for it. I think that the public exposure of that agenda is, in fact, why 42 corporations like those I named, GE and General Motors and Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Amazon, and others have dropped out. But there are a number of corporations, as you mentioned, Ian, that have not. State Farm has an ideologue at the top of its insurance organization. He has stood with Alec through thick and thin, and a lot of State Farm customers have no idea that their premiums are helping to pay for the Alec ideological agenda. You have AT&T and Verizon that are part of Alec. Comcast is part of Alec. these big telephone companies like those and telecom companies. And you have other corporations like UPS and FedEx. They're part of Alec. I think that people ought to know that, and they ought to ask them to get out of Alec, because what Alec has done with this gun agenda and with its broader agenda to make it harder for Americans to vote, to make it harder for us to have fully funded public schools and a public education system, to thwart efforts to increase the availability of insurance, including all types of insurance, which would include health insurance for mental health, to stop the effort to implement the ACA, which is known as Obamacare. Alec's agenda is an extreme agenda, an agenda of ideologues, and these companies either ought to get out or be held accountable for bankrolling it.
Just in closing, Lisa Graves, Mayor Bloomberg of New York, of course, has always been one of the few American politicians to call for sensible gun laws. And Dianne Feinstein, the California senator, is going to reintroduce the assault weapons ban that she originally got passed and then was allowed to expire in 2004. Now, Bloomberg is saying that the power of the NRA is exaggerated, and that's quite possible. So is there a way to expose them, not just expose Alec, but expose the NRA, and perhaps the emperor does have no clothes, and perhaps their bark is worse than their bite?
Well, I do think that the surveys I've seen indicate that a number of the people who are members of the NRA are hunters, and they know that you don't use these guns to hunt deer. There's no reason you need a 30 round clip of ammunition to shoot a deer. If you shot a deer that much, you'd have very little deer left, quite frankly, for steaks and dinner. They know that these guns are designed for the military. Their primary purpose is to kill people and kill people as quickly as possible. And so I think that there's actually a fissure emerging in some ways within the so-called gun community, including members of the NRA, who recognize that these sorts of tragedies are intolerable, because they are intolerable. I also think, quite frankly, while the NRA is a membership organization, there's no doubt that they have many members who pay a very small amount to be part of the NRA. The fact is that the NRA is largely bankrolled by some of these enormous gun manufacturers. When you look at Wayne LaPierre, the head of the NRA's salary, it is not a regular nonprofit salary. It's a CEO, it's a corporate-type salary. You can look it up. We'll put it online on PR Watch and Alec Exposed. He's paid a huge salary because he's basically paid a corporate salary. And he's paid that salary because his organization is primarily funded by some of these enormous global weapons manufacturers. I think that there's room to expose the NRA, expose their agenda, and also, quite frankly, for citizens to stand up for politicians who stand up to the NRA, and also to hold accountable politicians who want to do the bidding of not just the NRA, but quite frankly, the global merchants of these weapons, these massively deadly weapons, and hold them accountable. And I would say, I guess, in closing, in some respects, people have said this kid would have caused harm no matter what. He could have built a bomb. But I'll tell you what, we don't have bomb stores on every corner, because we know that a bomb has the capacity to destroy dozens of lives in an instant, just as some of these military-style weapons with these big clips of ammunition and these fast triggers can destroy the lives of 20 kids, 26 and 7-year-olds in Connecticut, and their teachers. And I think it's time for the country to do something about it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Lisa Graves.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and the publisher of PR Watch, alecexposed.org, SourceWatch, and Bankster USA. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. We're going to take a brief station break and discuss the denigration of the teaching profession, yet six heroic teachers died protecting young children.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. Previously, he taught at Boston University and Penn State University, and is the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, Politics After Hope, Obama and the Crisis of Youth, Race and Democracy, and The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be here.
And obviously, the teachers in this school in Newton, Connecticut, were heroes. Five of them died trying to protect the students. And yet, as a culture, as a nation, in terms of our political debate, teachers are being vilified. So is this incident, as much as it may wake America up in terms of its insane gun laws, is it possible that America will also wake up in terms of this unnecessary war against teachers?
I'm not optimistic. It certainly is an event that is so incomprehensible. I mean, the multiple killings of children, that it certainly should raise some fundamental questions about what it is in the larger culture that allows an event like this to even take place. And also, what is it in this culture that allows the discourse surrounding this event to be so limited, absolutely refusing to deal with larger socioeconomic and political issues at work that may produce these rage murders? I mean, this is a terrible event, but certainly is not new. I mean, I think in 2012, from what I understand, there have been 12 mass murders in the United States. And I guess the real question here is, you know, what is the formative culture at work underlying this kind of violence? I mean, where does it get legitimated, produced, sanctioned, and why is it that we can't talk about these kinds of events except within the narrow discourse of banning or regulating guns?
Well, I'm talking to you from Hollywood, right across the street from our studio is Universal Studios. And a lot of the movies that are being made by Hollywood, and certainly a lot of the television, you just look at the posters. There are people, men, women, actors, movie stars, all pointing guns out at us. So there's no question. And you just look at the new movies that are coming out. The Gay Scientologist, he's got a new movie coming out, all about violence, retribution, revenge. Guns have become the symbol of how men in America settle their problems.
No, it absolutely. I mean, we live in a war culture. You know, it's a culture that celebrates militarism. It's a culture that increasingly celebrates extreme forms of hypermasculinity. It's a culture that wallows in extreme sports. I mean, it's a culture for which violence seems to not only be one of the few mediating forces left that bring people together, but what scares me is that it's one of the few sources we have left that provides what we might call an ultimate form of pleasure. I mean, it's not really simply that it denigrates human beings and reifies them and in a sense puts into motion, you know, the worst kinds of values and social relationships, but it actually becomes one of the few outlets we have left. I mean, there was a story in the New York Times yesterday, a few days ago, about these yuppies, you know, who are now engaging in weekends rather than running marathons. They're sort of wallowing in the mud under electric fences, you know, looking for, you know, the ultimate kind of release in the face of what can only be described as a form of masculinity, that the only thing that they're not doing is carrying a machine gun on their backs, you know?
Well, you know, I've often wondered why it is that as a culture we can't change that notion that's so instilled, particularly in boys and men, that guns are connected to heroism, when in fact guns should be connected to cowardice. You know, I come from a different culture in Australia, and it's always been understood that, you know, men settle, if they have to settle their differences with their fists, that anybody who introduces a gun or a knife is considered an abject coward, and that there's a kind of shame associated with anybody that has a gun or a knife. I know, you know, it's not politically correct to talk about, you know, fisticuffs and settling your problems that way, but it seems to me to be at least less collateral damage than this obsession with guns that have led to these consistent and repetitive massacres.
I mean, it's an interesting analogy and commentary, and I think that, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood as a working class kid where anybody who had a knife or had a gun was completely seen as either completely loony or ultimately a coward as well. I mean, there was no investment in that kind of violence. But I think that what the question begs is, what's happened since the 1950s and 60s? I mean, particularly in the United States, to sort of celebrate endlessly the notion that gun is really probably the greatest extension that one can put into play, defining what masculinity is all about and how it should function in a time of crises. I mean, it's everywhere, you know. But I think that at the same time, you know, we have to realize that there's a broader spectrum of violence out there that increasingly legitimates that kind of practice. I mean, I'm worried about a society that shatters all social bonds. You know, I'm worried about a society that, through these market-driven precepts and values, you know, just trades in massive social, political, and economic dislocations. And in doing so, ultimately blames the individual for them. I mean, it has no language of the social. So that whenever the social emerges, the only thing that we can do is disparage it or disdain it. And hence, public institutions, you know, public schools, mental health institutions. I mean, all these institutions now are seen as objects of disparagement. So it's really, couple that with the fact that we teach kids that the best thing they can do to improve their eyesight is to be a first shooter in a video game. And we, you know, we might have to ask ourselves, you know, what is it that allows this culture to allow kids both to believe that to shoot a gun is a great thing, but at the same time is horrified when kids are the object of those shootings? And what is it about the larger culture that allows that to take place?
Now, the reason I called you, Henry, was that you've been writing recently about how corporations are, in fact, waging a war against our teachers, and particularly our public teachers, and there's no question that that is happening. Tie that in to the current situation, then. I suppose that it's pretty obvious that we all ought to be recognizing that the teachers at this school, this elementary school in Connecticut, laid down their lives protecting these children in the way that we expect our soldiers to do. And yet, as a culture, we're allowing corporate America, ALEC, and the Republican Party to vilify teachers and to do everything they can to take away their union rights and downsize them and fire them.
I mean, I think that a couple of things emerge out of that beautifully articulated sentiment. And I think that one is that, of course, what Sandy Hook exhibits is how profoundly important teachers really are, and how heroic they are, and how brave they are, and how crucial they are to public life. I mean, if you want to measure the nature of a society by the way in which it represents and treats its children, the first place you really want to go is to schools. So schools should really be the most important institutions that we have in a society, not the military, but schools. And so the question then emerges, what is it that allows these teachers to be denigrated in ways that are just almost incomprehensible to me? I mean, they're called welfare queens, they're called cheaters, they're moochers, their pensions are being taken away, they're under attack. And I think that what we see happening here is a kind of market-driven fundamentalism coupled with a religious fundamentalism in many respects that just really hates a couple of things. It hates democracy, it hates public values, it hates public goods, it doesn't have a high regard for young people. And basically, it would like to turn the society in almost all of its institutions over to the profit mongers. You know, the same people who gave us the 2008 economic crisis, the same people who basically are laundering money for terrorists. You know, the bankers and these financial crooks. And it's really shocking. And I think that if we don't gain control of what it means for power to be concentrated in relatively few hands in the United States, we are increasingly going to move into an authoritarian society that will basically be governed by a militia, that will basically be governed by the military. I mean, there is no question that democracy is dead in the United States. And I think increasingly the collateral damage of that death is being seen in the victims that we see all around us. You know, from people who are losing their houses, the kids who are being killed, the teachers who are being laid off. And I don't want to establish a false equivalency because there are different degrees of suffering here. But they're all part of the same pattern of abuse and violence that is now both systemic and horrendous.
Well, we know to some extent when you talk about those that are taking over the United States or have perhaps taken over the United States, there are these very malignant oligarchs like the Koch brothers,
right,
who through the American Legislative Exchange Council,
right,
have managed to get these model laws, many of them with the NRA as an adjunct to them. But the last election, many of us thought that the Koch brothers and the oligarchs would have bought it outright, which is what they were trying to do, and the Supreme Court's enabled them to do so. But they weren't able to buy it outright. So do you think there's any possibility of a pushback? Or?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, what I'm characterizing here are what I would call dominant trends towards authoritarianism. I mean, but at the same time, you have an Occupy movement, you know, that as fragmented as it is, at least has started a new kind of conversation. You have unions that are beginning to mobilize. You have workers. You have teachers. I mean, resistance is far from dead in the United States. And increasingly, I really do hope that it will grow and become more organized, and we'll have larger social movements and third parties, anything to, for the most part, to take party and establish it. Take power and establish it outside of the established range of politics. I mean, I think the United States is on a brink, you know, and I don't think there are any political guarantees about where it'll go. But I certainly think that we are at a turning point in our history. I mean, given the way in which money is being concentrated, given the massive inequality that exists in the United States, and given the sheer arrogance of what I would call ruling groups today, who really, I believe, think they're unaccountable. I mean, this recent scandal,
HSBC, yeah, the British.
I mean, can you imagine not leveling criminal charges against a bank that launders money from terrorists, and yet we'll put somebody in jail for life? Who has 2 ounces of grass in them if it's a third strike? It's incomprehensible to me. So I guess what is being learned here about the separation of politics and power? What's being learned is that if you have money, you know, and in power, you're unaccountable. And I think that's going to change. And I think there has to be a massive educational effort, to say the very least, to change the collective consciousness about what a democracy might look like as opposed to what it really is. And maybe the Sandy Hook massacre will do that. Maybe we not only will unravel the perniciousness of a gun culture, but we'll start to connect the dots as to, say, you know, give us some sort of broader understanding of where this kind of violence comes from and what it means and how central it is to the culture itself.
And just in closing, though, Henry Giroux, will it end or at least perhaps stall this war against teachers?
I would love to see it end, but it'll simply stall it. I mean, the right wing in the United States, these are religious fundamentalists, the political and religious fundamentalists. I mean, they live in circles of certainty. They don't doubt themselves whatsoever. I don't think the NRA will even budge over this. It may keep quiet for a week, but I think this is a real struggle, and I don't think we should assume whatsoever that this will guarantee the development of a new understanding of what gun violence is about and how it should be stopped. This has to be worked at, meaning that we have to learn from this and then we have to organize in order for this to stop. But I think the last thing we should do is just assume that the nature of the horror has been so over the top that it'll automatically guarantee anything.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Henry Giroux.
Okay, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. He's the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, Politics After Hope, Obama and the Crisis of Youth, Race and Democracy, and The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings.
It's just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by. Our choices here are growing. As children grow, they grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are rampaging disease. In our minds we build the blocks to what we need. In our minds we're reaching out for peace. In our hearts we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts a sense of master feed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Catherine Newman, who is the Dean of the School of the Arts and Sciences and Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings, and has an article at CNN in School Shootings, Patterns and Warning Signs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Newman.
Thank you so much.
And in your article, Catherine, you mentioned talking about the kind of symmetry here, if you will, with these young, disturbed boys and young men who conduct these mass shootings at schools, the latest of whom, of course, is Adam Lanza. You're saying that though they're often intelligent, high-performing boys, their peers tend to see them as unattractive losers, weak and unmanly. Isn't that a part of our problem here? Here I am talking to you from Hollywood. Across the street from the studio is Universal Studios. In our culture, don't we associate guns with manliness and heroism?
Sadly, we do in popular culture. In real life, of course, that's not really what we see. And so in the communities where these boys are growing up, they see men who are, you know, truck drivers and lawyers and doctors and teachers. That's what real men look like. But in popular culture, I think it's true that we tend to see an association between violence and manliness. And unfortunately, popular culture is what is most powerful in projecting images to teenagers. And that is what these boys tend to rivet on. And it does drive them toward events and actions that they think will gain them the attention they want and the persona, more to the point, that they desperately desire, which is an improvement over the persona everyone sees in them.
Well, you did research after a number of these shootings. I think was it the Paducah, Kentucky shooting? Was it the boy there who thought that by shooting these kids, he'd become more popular?
Yes. When he was asked what he thought was going to happen when the shooting was over, he said, well, I thought they would come to my house and I would go to their house and I would be cool and I would have friends. And sadly, friends is what he really wanted. And unfortunately, this was the method he thought would gather him those friends. And it sounds almost bizarre that that's the case, but he had had many episodes of other attempts to gain attention, all of which failed. And when he started talking about shooting people, all of a sudden, the groups he was trying to ingratiate himself with started to pay attention. So sadly, what we discover is that these attention-getting comments work. And because they work, they create commitments that young boys are making in a rather public way. And for them to default on those promises to shoot people looks like one more social failure. They can't back away from it.
So when you have these shooters like Adam Lanza, and I suppose the shooter in Colorado didn't want to go out in a blaze of glory, But I think the one at Virginia Tech, and I just spoke yesterday with a survivor of Virginia Tech who still has three of the four bullets in his body. He was one of seven survivors out of a class of 17. I believe that shooter killed himself, and clearly Adam Lanza did. And you mentioned in your article, Catherine Newman, the in-school shootings, patterns, and warning signs. And, of course, you've researched this subject for your book, Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shooting. The notion that, quoting you, many of these young men are trying to cast themselves as stars of a movie that ends in a blaze of suicidal gunfire and notoriety.
That's exactly the point. They think of that as a more appealing public image than the public image they have, which is one of socially awkward, frictional relations with other people. They're looking for an alternative, and the alternative that popular culture shows them is this blazing gunman, and frequently they will dress in trench coats because they think that looks cool, and that's what the social imagery is showing them. And so, unfortunately, what they're seeking is a way to change the way their peers see them. And sadly, none of their other efforts bear fruit. But this dramatic anti-hero action does bear fruit. And it does long before they do the shooting. People do start paying attention. In fact, we have evidence of other kids egging them on. When Michael Carneal, one of the shooters we studied in Kentucky, stole a gun and came to school, the goth group that he was desperate to impress said, "Oh, no, we don't like that gun. We want you to bring a shotgun." So Michael turned around and brought a shotgun and shot three kids with it. So he was a very vulnerable, impressionable young man who was desperate to get the approval of these older boys who seemed cool to him. And this was the method, and the only method that actually worked, because all of his earlier pranks, stealing CDs, telling loud jokes, sticking gum in girls' hair, none of that worked. That just further labeled him as an out-of-touch dweeb.
So it isn't the real problem here, though, that our law enforcement in the United States is hamstrung, as is no other law enforcement organization in the advanced industrial world, like we are, because of the lobbying efforts of the NRA that have all but neutered the ATF, the agency that's supposed to monitor firearms, the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives Agency. And one of the things the NRA succeeded in doing is preventing any law enforcement from sharing data on those that are mentally ill or have a history thereof and those who purchase guns. So I'm not sure that the psychological background and motivations of these children are as important as the fact that as a society, there's no way to know there's no tracking in terms of their mental illness and those that buy guns. And isn't that where we should be focusing our efforts on simply preventing people with a history of mental illness from being able to purchase firearms or get their hands on firearms?
I think there's a great deal that we could do from a policy point of view to address issues like the one you've just raised. And I certainly concur with you that it's a form of social madness to permit people who are so disturbed from getting their hands on guns. I think the NRA has an awful lot to answer for, and perhaps they finally will have to answer, because one feels a certain seismic shift in the country today, and let's hope that that persists long enough to actually do something. But I have to offer a slight caution here, and that is that what gun control and these kinds of measures will do is to make it much more difficult for the ambivalent would-be shooter to get his hands on a gun and do damage. And there are many more people who are ambivalent about these actions than there are people who are completely committed and I think largely unstoppable from a gun control point of view. So we need gun control. We need the measures you've talked about to stop the sort of mildly committed. But someone who is really determined to get their hands on guns will find a way, even in societies that have extraordinary
gun control. And for that, we need additional remedies. We need to encourage people who hear threats to come forward. We need to be sure that those threats are taken seriously. We need to address the mental health, the vast reservoir of mental health needs that are going untreated. We need to educate our young people that bullying or social ostracism can have extraordinary costs, and that they need to be more reflective about the damage they may be doing. It's part of the peer experience. We can all remember what teenage life was like. Very few of us in adulthood want to go back to it because it's not an easy time of life, and these forms of ostracism are very painful. And we need our children to understand that that can be extremely dangerous and damaging. So I would argue with that the gun control and other policy remedies you've mentioned are extremely important. They are necessary conditions, but they will not by themselves address the issues involved in a totally dedicated, determined shooter. And for that, we need a much more comprehensive strategy, of which this is just a part.
But Catherine Newman, then what about the broader issue of social responsibility, in the sense that our media, movies and television, you can't basically go by a movie poster without seeing a gun pointed at you, or watch a TV show without people pointing and shooting guns. And for example, in the culture where I grew up, Australia, sometimes in a macho culture, people settle their issues with fists. But if anybody introduced a gun or a knife, they would be considered abject cowards. And we live in a culture where guns are not instruments of cowardice. They are the means by which problems are solved and people become heroes. So why not change that cultural vector? Why not make guns instruments of shame and cowardice, as opposed to problem solvers and heroic instruments?
Well, I'm completely with you on this. I have no objection to that idea at all, and I think you might want to talk to the people across the street who are, in many ways, the creators of the popular culture images that are so influential in our society, because up until now, anyway, they've sort of gone the other direction, and that is regrettable, and it has consequences. And I think we all, as you say, do need to examine for ourselves why we find those images so appealing. And it would be helpful if we didn't, and if we turned them off and made them commercially unsuccessful. I mean, sadly, they are commercially very successful, and it would be better if they weren't. So I don't disagree with you about the critique you're offering. I think they play a powerful role in a very negative set of motivations that very marginal boys feel rather strongly. Now, there are other things that I think are consistent with this that we should pay attention to. In big cities, boys who have different interests, interested in, I don't know, chess or dance or classics or whatever, they can find a niche, and they do. The problem for the marginal boy who's in a small rural town is that there are very few alternatives that are socially satisfying. Most of these boys who become shooters are very high functioning. They're smart. They're often very interested in academic subjects, and they don't get a lot of social reinforcement for that. If they're not also good at football, their social options are very limited. And we should be asking ourselves about that too, because our definitions of masculinity that begin to fall into place when young boys are, 14 years old, are extremely limiting if you're not fortunate enough to be in a big city like Los Angeles or New York, where there are many options to find a niche. There are not so many options in places like Jonesboro, Arkansas, or probably in this small town in Connecticut, because small towns tend not to be quite as diverse in representations of masculinity. And it matters. It really matters. The reason these boys feel so marginal is that they are mentally ill, and that sets them off on a path, and then it's exacerbated by finding so little social support for the things that do interest them. And now if we take them away and just look at the kids who aren't going to shoot anybody but are actually some of the most upstanding sort of citizens of those high schools, we found that the strong students complained to us that nobody ever holds a parade for the winners of the academic marathon or college bowl. They hold a parade only for the kids who are good at sports. Well, why is that? And it's not only what the school does, why do the rest of us attend celebrations of, you know, sports teams, but we don't attend or even throw celebrations for, you know, the kid who wins the math Olympiad? We really need to examine the whole range of ways in which we validate what it means to be a successful young man or a successful young woman and find more diverse opportunities for people to be honored.
Well, just in closing there, Catherine Newman, you mentioned having a parade. But in this society and in our culture of late, particularly in our politics, the very profession of teachers has been denigrated, and they've been downsized, and their unions have been defunded. And I think in many ways that it's pretty clear to me, at least, that the teachers involved in this school in Connecticut, the six who died, they died protecting young children. They died like soldiers in war. They took bullets to protect children, and they're heroes. I mean, so do you think as a society we're going to start valuing teachers more and stop denigrating them?
Well, I wish we would. I think your point is extremely well taken. We never give teachers the credit that they deserve, and I must tell you that some of the saddest interviews that we did in connection with the book Rampage were of teachers who had served in schools that had been traumatized in this way, and they found that people were very impatient with them. They expected them to be mental health treatment officials when they had no background. They were math teachers or social studies teachers. Their insurance policies did not cover them for the mental health needs they had in the aftermath of these bloodbaths. So not only did we not particularly value them when they were doing their normal jobs, when they were on the receiving end of this horrible violence, we weren't providing proper health care for them. We were expecting them to come back to work within a week or two and take care of everybody else. Meanwhile, you know, some of them had been shot at. And so I think in general, we don't think enough about who they are, what they contribute, and how they need to be cared for. I think you will find that the teachers in this school in Newton, Connecticut, are going to be themselves just as shaken up as any of the parents or the surviving children, and they're going to need to be cared for. And I hope we will have learned some lessons from earlier shootings and step up. But there wasn't much evidence of that in the schools that I looked at. And in the one in Arkansas, half the teachers left the profession within 3 years. They were so disturbed. So I'm sorry to say that the kind of fluorescence of solidarity that you see now in this traumatized town doesn't carry people all the way through to where they need to get to recover. That is a very long-term proposition.
Well, Catherine Newman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Catherine Newman, who's the Dean of the School of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. She's the author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings, and she has an article at CNN in School Shootings, Patterns, and Warning Signs. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll answer your questions as best I can. The conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.